But if I can transfer blame to them, then I'm free to go right ahead with my life and continue transferring all blame to other people.
That's right.
And when I saw that, I realized how sick I really was, and I realized why I loved resentments. And you know, there wasn't a name on that list that I hadn't done something to. The police department, I never did have them come up and just knock hell out of me. Always I was doing something I shouldn't be doing. The post office, the Internal Revenue Service, all those things, I did something to those people, places, and things, and they simply retaliated against me, and then I used the resentment to transfer blame and used it to justify doing what I wanted to do in the future. That's exactly what this lady did in Freedom from Bondage. That's exactly what I did. Now, the instant I realized that, I realized that every name on that list was somebody or something that I had harmed, and they are going to come off of that list later on, and they're going to be part of my Step 8 list when I get to it. Now, even if we're in a situation where we really didn't do anything, maybe as a kid growing up, they did something to us, and we didn't have any part in that. But today, as adults, if we were not so selfish, so dishonest, so self-seeking and frightened and inconsiderate of other people, we could forgive them for that and let them have a useful, happy life for as long as they're going to live, too. And the real thing is, if we get rid of that resentment, then we're free from that. And if we got a resentment today we're holding on to and won't turn loose, I think we ought to look at it very carefully, because we're probably using it for rationalization and justification. We're probably using it to rationalize doing things we shouldn't do or not doing things that we ought to do. And if we carefully look at those, we'll find out that's what we're doing with them. You know, I see it more and more and more in AA every day, where we sit around and we talk about what they did to us and use that to justify why we are the way we are today. And rather than use that as an excuse, let's look at the resentment, let's analyze it, let's see why we can't get rid of it, and let's get that thing out of our lives. And then we can go on and be peaceful, happy, free. As long as we sit around and discuss it in meetings, then one person, sick person, is feeding off another sick person. Just like discussing chemical dependency. If we use our steps, chemical dependency disappears. If we use our steps, resentments will disappear, but only when we want to do that. And if we're using it for rationalization and justification, watch it. It may cause us to drink. Joe?
Yeah, I think one of the greatest columns, the fourth column, if we have a problem with it, some of the deep resentments, we're going to find our relief in the fourth column. You know, I had a deep resentment against my mother-in-law. You know, I thought it was legal to keep those from my first marriage. And when I came to AA, you know, and they started talking about these things, I just made the decision, well, they're getting into this, but this is one of those that we don't discuss. You know, I'm going to hide this one and take it to the grave and hold on to this one. After a while, you know, I found that, you know, I had to deal with it, and we put it down and analyzed it. And of course, what she had done, she had broken up my marriage. She'd interfered with my marriage. The way I looked at it, and the way I'd always replayed it, she interfered with my marriage, and what that did, that affected everything. It affected my personal relationship. It affected my self-esteem. It affected my material, my emotional security. It affected my sex life. It affected all my ambitions. And I really hated that woman. I mean, I used to get drunk over it. Even after I was sober, I could just sit up and dwell on it, you know. And I would want to get out of it, but I had tried several times over the years, but I finally just didn't get into that fourth column. And finally, I was able to, when we got into this, I could look at that fourth column to really get the real freedom. And I was always staring at what she did. And I said, look at the fourth column. But regardless of what they did, look at what you did. And I said, nothing. No, I didn't do nothing. What do you mean, what did I do? She just come in and broke up my marriage. I didn't do nothing, yeah. And it was blank, you know. But then I was able to look finally, and I was able to see what I did. You know, I was able to see how my selfishness, honest, and my self-seeking and my inconsideration for, not to her, didn't hurt her, but I hurt the people she loved, her daughter and her grandkids. Godly, did I hurt them. And the only thing that woman did was what any decent woman would do. She did what she did to protect the people she loved. Okay? And it was all my fault. And then finally, you know, I finally seen after all those years of that woman that I resented all those years that I owe that woman a man. They said you should have been making out step four. In the step four, you should be making the list for step eight. See, some of these people I resented go on the step eight list, and she was at the top of the list. Okay? And I made an amend to her. Because, you know, if we have done this right, it says we should be making out the list for step eight and nine. So in the first column on that sheet, we have the list for step eight and nine. Some eight and nines on that people were resented as eight and nine. You know, and step three is in the third column. That's the part of self that was affected. In the fourth column, you know, the exact nature of our wrong, fault, mistakes, that's really some valuable information. In that column, that's the thing we're going to talk to another person about in step five. That's the things we're going to become willing to let go of in step six. And the things we're going to ask God to remove in step nine. I mean, you know, in step seven, rather. So we got the information in that last column for 4, 5, 6, and 7. And we got the people, as far as resentment's concerned, that we owe amend in step 8 and 9. So if we work step 4 on the resentments according to the big book, then we got all the information for 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 already on this sheet laid out for the rest of our program. And, you know, after we do that, then this is the process of the inventory, is to gather all the information for our resentments from the rest of the program. And then we're going to go through, as we complete the inventory tomorrow, we're going to do the same thing with fear. And then we're going to do the same thing with harm dust. If we do it exactly like the big book. Now, if everybody here, if we listed and analyzed all of our fears and got rid of 95% of them and prayed and got the rest of them out, then all the resentments are gone. Now, if all the resentments are gone, we're carrying out the decision in step three. Remember, in step three, we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. Now, if we have cleared away the resentments that block us from God, God can come in and occupy that part of our minds. So we are carrying out the decision in step three by the actions that we're taking in step four. Step four is a very positive step. It's a cleansing step. It's not a negative thing if we can really see what the book does. And John and I are always glad at the end of these things on Saturday evening, because we know when everybody comes back to Sunday morning, this whole group here, it's going to be great in the morning. Everybody here is going to be resentment free. Great, you know, going to be totally free in the morning.
I think in that fourth column, and we're going to see in the morning, where Bill paid no attention to the use of these words. He used them interchangeably. One place he talks about defects, another one faults, another one mistakes, another one shortcomings. And it's apparent that what he was talking about is the part of our nature, the old personality, that causes us to do the things that hurt people, that cause them to retaliate, which creates the resentment in the first place. So it really doesn't make any difference what we call them. Those are the things we're going to have to change. If I stay selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, and inconsiderate, I'm going to keep right on doing the same things I've always done, keep right on hurting people, and they're going to retaliate back against me, and I'll have new resentments in the future. So not only have I found how to get rid of those I have today, that damaged and unsalable goods, that stock in trade called resentments, has now left my mind. I also have a way to keep them from coming back in the future. By changing that old personality, I quit doing those things that I used to do. And I quit hurting people, and the resentments will not come back. So that part of the shelf stays free of resentments. Now, God does not allow a vacuum anywhere in our universe. Voids and vacuums are always being filled up with something. If this resentment goes, if that shelf comes open, then it's going to have to be filled with a new stock in trade. And the new stock in trade might be compassion, understanding, patience, love, tolerance of other people. And if I've got that, then I just might be sober and peaceful, happy, and free in that part of my mind. And I've got less chance of taking a drink. You see, this lays out everything that you and I are going to need, resentment-wise, through the rest of our program. Tomorrow we're going to do the same thing with fear, and then we're going to do the same thing with sex. But today we're tired, you're tired, and we got a headache, and we don't feel like sex this afternoon. So let's wait and we'll deal with sex in the morning. You know? A little sex on Sunday morning is not a bad thing at all. Thank you all for being here today. Hope to see you in the morning, and we'll finish up tomorrow morning. Joe said he wasn't going to start with sex. He hadn't had enough practice at Hickory Dickory Dock yet. My name is Charlie Farman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for the grace of the power that I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to take a drink for 6,577 days today, one day at a time. For this, I'm very grateful. Everybody get a good night's sleep. Everybody rested up, have a good breakfast. How about one little story this morning, real fast, before we start, huh? Any Catholics in the room?
No Catholics.
No Catholics. It's the only place in the world I've ever been you don't find any Catholics. We've been picking on Baptists quite a bit the last two or three days. We heard a little story about a Catholic boy not long ago, a young boy just reaching the age of puberty. And he began to wonder what goes on in his mother's bedroom. And one day while she was out, he decided to sneak in and look around and see what he could see. And while in there, he heard his mother coming down the hallway. And he knew he'd be in trouble if he got caught, so he runs and he hides in the closet. And after a while, mother comes in, but mother isn't by herself. She has her boyfriend with her. And mother and boyfriend got to doing what mothers and boyfriends do in afternoons and bedrooms. And suddenly they heard father coming down the hallway. And mother said to the boyfriend, "My God, quick, get in the closet. If he catches us, he'll kill us both." So the boyfriend gets in the closet also. And after a while, the little boy said, "Sure is dark in here, isn't it?" And the boyfriend said, yeah, it is. And the little boy said, "I've got a catcher's mitt I've been wanting to sell." And he said, "I believe you ought to buy it." And the boyfriend said, "Well, I guess so. How much you want for it?" And he said, "Oh, about $40. Boyfriend said, "That's a hell of a lot of money, but yeah, I'll buy it." And after a while, the little boy said, "And I've got a bat that goes with that also." And said, "You ought to buy that bat, too." The boyfriend said, "Well, I guess. What do you want for it?" And he said, $20. And the boyfriend said, "Okay." And after a while, the little boy said, "And there's a ball goes with that that makes up a set." And said, "You really need to buy it, too." Boyfriend said, "I guess so. How much you want?" He said, $10. Boyfriend said, "Okay." Now, the next afternoon, the little boy is sitting in the living room, and he's counting his money. And his mother comes through and sees it, and she said, "Son, where'd you get all that money?" He said, "Mother, I can't tell you." She said, "You are going to tell me. Where in the world did you get that kind of money?" And he said, "Mother, really, I can't tell you." And she said, "You're going to." She jerks him up. She takes him down to church. She throws him in a confessional. In a little while, the priest comes in and sits down, and nobody says anything for a while. And after a while, the priest said, "My child, what is it you have on your mind?" The little boy said, "Sure is dark in here, isn't it?" And the priest said, "Are you going to start that shit again?" That's our Sunday morning spiritual joke. And that's about as spiritual as we're going to get, Joe.
Oh, my name is Joe, and I'm a real alcoholic. Through God's grace, because this program works, I have found necessary to take a drink of alcohol since March of 1962, and for this I'm grateful. I was sharing that talk last night. I think of the size of the group, and we got into the inventory and went over. I
a lot of in-depth in the inventory yesterday, and I think it was I really enjoyed it. I think we all learned a lot about the simplicity of the inventory. As we began the inventory, we inventoried our resentments. And we talked about that we were going to inventory the three manifestations of self. And we also talked about these things being related lack of power. That is our dilemma.
But I don't do a damn bit of good unless I can find the receptor.
Now, you got it out of the way. You got to move it. Do something. Move it back. Up.
Still something.
Move it back.
No, it's not right. There's something wrong. Somewhere. Anybody else know anything about this stuff? It's not bright.
Sure not as bright as it was yesterday.
You just got an adjustment on the back there. Yeah. Well, we'll do it without it. We said that we went through them, and we also mentioned, I think, that it's a real fine point that we're trying to bring out too, that, you know, resentments is a one of the symptoms of spiritual sickness. And I think what we're doing here is really going to list and analyze those things and get down. And he said when we get spiritually well, then these things will become mentally and physically well. And we started by making a list in the first column of every person, institution, and thing we resented. And we talked about that this shouldn't be too hard for an alcoholic, because an alcoholic is real familiar with who he resents. It amazes me that when you start talking to an alcoholic about doing an inventory, they say they can't do an inventory, although they've been talking about their resentments for the last 15 years. So it ought to be easy enough to put down who you resent. And then the next column, the cause. And this is, we all know what they did. We have reinforced this over and over. And then once we get this information down, then we can get down from that, we can trace that to the real information. You know, which part of self was affected. And we can indicate that in each column. And then this brings us to the fourth column. For the first time, we're able to look at ourselves. We read this across and look at our involvement in each resentment. In each case, it's totally impossible not to have a resentment without one part of self being involved. One character defect has to be involved, because if it wasn't for the character defect, that's the main thing we're looking about, is the fourth column. The things we're going to talk about in step 5, 6, 7, 8, and then we're going to have the list for 8 and 9. But I think that we have used the resentment, as we said later on, to cover up these things, to put blame on other people and not look at ourselves. And I think really, as we list and analyze these things, we see it's for the first opportunity, we force ourselves to look at ourselves. And we can see the thing within us that really caused the resentments. There is no way, hardly, that we can have a resentment and play it over without having, being selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, inconsiderate. One of these causative effects has to have raised its head. Now, not only are we inventorying the resentments, as we said, we're learning something to reuse for the rest of our lives. Because when we get into step 10, on a daily basis, all we got to do is use this same process. You know, as a resentment comes up each day, all I got to do is say, what is it? What did they do? Which part of self is involved? What's wrong with me? And I can see that immediately in a few minutes. I can look at myself, and I can see what I have to change. And I can see what I need to discuss with another human being if possible. And I see what I need to ask God to remove. If I've harmed anybody, I can get it over it. And I can process this resentment right away. But I learned to do this in step 4. So step 4 not only gets rid of the old resentments, it gives me a tool to use the rest of my life on resentments. So it's a teaching process. It's a learning process. If we use this, learn to do the, if we do the inventory one time, it gets rid of our resentments and it gives us a tool to use for the rest of our lives. And this is the process of using the big book. Now once we have done that, then he comes to the bottom of the page. He says, you know, we're talking about the next manifestation, the next thing that we're going to look at that indicates spiritual sickness is fear. And we come to notice the word fear, which is bracketed along the difficulties of Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employee, and his wife. This short word somehow touches almost every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and cordoning thread. The fabric of our resistance was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune which we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves, you know, this is what we need to look at. If we got fear, we ourselves set the ball to rolling. Again, just like resentments. You know, when we finally got down and analyzed the resentments, we find that the root cause of resentments was our own selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seeking, the frightening, inconsiderate character. Now, when we get down to the bottom of fear and analyze it, we're going to find out that most of our fears can be traced back to our own selfishness, self-centered, inconsiderate, frightened, dishonest character. Those are the root causes of the fear. Fear is not the problem. You know. So, but we won't know that until we analyze these fears. Now, we think our fear ought to be classed with stealing. It causes more trouble. So we're going to use the same part. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. And this is the only way you can do. You can only, the human being, you know, we just have one fear at a time, just like we have one resentment at a time. You don't know how fear dominates your life until you put them all down because you can't see but one at a time. You really can't. You can't see but one of these things at a time. Feel me? So we're going to do the same problem. We're going to list and analyze our fears. Now, this is a beautiful process. Okay. We put them on paper even though we had no connections, no resentment in connection with them. We put them on paper. Now, that's the first column. We list our fears. Everything that we fear. We fear, you know, we as human beings, we fear a lot of different things. Then the next column, after we put, we asked ourselves why we had them. What is the cause of the fear? Then the third column, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? You know, you can't have a fear unless one of your basic instincts of life is threatened. You know? Does it threaten your self-esteem? Did it threaten a personal relationship? Did it threaten your pocketbook, material security? Oh, boy. Did it threaten our emotional security? Or did it threaten your sex life? One part of self has to be in danger or threatened some way in order for us to have fear. But we never look at that. We always started to fear. never been able to look and analyze it, I said. And then once we see which part of self is threatened, then we can go in the fourth column and see which character defect has allowed that to happen. Are we selfish again? Are we self-centered? Are we frightened? Are we inconsiderate? Have we been dishonest? We will always find that once we listen and analyze it, that one of the character defects has raised its head. You know, one part of our character is out of whack. So,
we're going to see Bill doing the same thing here that he's done all the way through the book. We see the same set of instructions for fear that we did for resentments, except he's worded them in a slightly different manner. But we see the same instructions to list the fear, column 1, ask ourselves why we had them, column 2, and then see which part of self, column 3. Now, this is not an attempt to psychoanalyze ourselves. You know, some fears that we have, maybe we don't know why we have them. Some fears really are good. You know, fear brings caution. And if we don't have some caution, it'd be difficult for us to even walk across the street without getting run over if we didn't have some fear. If we didn't have some fear of what people think of us, we couldn't have this meeting here this morning. Hell, we'd all tell each other what we really think, and by God, it'd break up pretty fast, you know. So what we're really going to look at are those fears that tend to really drive us and cause us to do unreasonable things. Some fears, like the fear of the dark. Well, if I don't know why I've got that, I'm simply going to put down, I don't know. But really, I'm supposed to be afraid of the dark because I don't have headlights and I can't see at night. You know, fear of heights. I'm supposed to be afraid of the heights. I don't have wings and I can't fly. See, those are the kind of fears that bring caution and are really helpful to us. But now, many of us have fears like, for instance, I had a fear of the Internal Revenue Service. Well, why did I have that? Well, the reason I had that is because I cheated on my damned income tax. That's why I had that fear. Now, which part of self caused that? You know, did I cheat on my income tax to have the money to impress somebody else? Or to build my self-esteem or develop a personal relationship? Did I cheat on my income tax for material security?
Yeah.
Or did I cheat on my income tax for sex purposes to have the money for things in the sexual area? See, always there's a root cause. The fear is the wrong. That's what's blocking me off from God's will. That's the spiritual sickness symptom that I'm looking at. But what is the root cause of the fear? What's the exact nature of that wrong? That's what the fourth column gets us into. And if I'm a spiritually sick person, I'm going to develop a certain kind of personality. And that personality is going to be selfish, dishonest, self-seeking and frightened, and inconsiderate of other people. So what is the real root cause of this fear? Is it because of my selfishness? Is it because of dishonesty? Is it because of the fact that I'm a frightened, fearful person with no courage? Or is it caused by inconsideration of other people? And invariably, when I look at fears, like I looked at resentments, disregarding those other people, looking at myself, I begin to realize that I'm the root cause of most of my fears. I usually do something based upon self that puts me in a position to experience that fear. Now, I said yesterday Barbara was on the resentment sheet, but Barbara was also on the fear sheet. Because I'm not even sure today what she will do if she really finds out all those things I was doing 18 years ago. Now, Barbara was not the cause of the fear. The things that I did based on self, because of my selfishness, self-seeking, dishonest, frightened, inconsiderate character, put me in a position to feel that fear. I'm still afraid of the police department. By God, when the highway patrol pulls in behind me, I just get shaky as hell. Why? Because of things I used to do. And I can always find a basic root cause for the majority of these fears. And I see that the same thing happens here in resentments. The old character that I used to be creates the fear. Now, if I can get rid of those things in that fourth column, then I'm not going to have to experience fear. If I can get rid of selfishness, I don't put myself in those positions. If I can get rid of dishonesty, I don't put myself in those positions. If I can get rid of the self-seeking, frightened individual that I am, then I'm going to have courage. If I can get rid of inconsideration, I'm not going to be putting myself in those positions. Most of my fears, they have a basic root cause which really stem from me and the things that I do. And I begin to see the same character creating fear that created the resentments. And if I don't get rid of that, I'll never have any peace of mind, period. Now, the book tells me how to analyze fear, how to look at it, how to analyze it, and now it's going to tell me how to get rid of those that remain. Now, these fears are just like resentments. When you put them down on paper, they look pretty damn dumb. They really do. We've never looked at them, see, completely. And most of them look just dumb as hell. And we don't like to appear as dumb people. And most of them are so ridiculous, they'll disappear. But there may be a few that are deep-rooted that will stay with us. And we're going to handle them just like resentments. We're going to have to use prayer. Only God has the power to overcome self. And fear stems from self. So with God's help, we can overcome all fear. Joe?
Perhaps there's a better way. We think so. For we're now on a different basis. A basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust the infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent we do as we think He would have us, we humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize for anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can lawfully those who think spirituality is a way of weakness. Paradoxically, a way of strength. The verdict of ages is faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God and never apologize for God. Instead, they let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. And now we have the fear of prayer. We ask Him to remove our fears and to direct our attention to what He would have us be. And He says, at once we commence to outgrow fear. And we use fear on those deep resentments.
Prayer
on those deep resentments, deep fears that, you know, that are not, that we can't seem to work and see our way through. As we said, as Charlie said, just like in resentments, 99% of these things will disappear when we list and analyze them. Some of them will remain, and if we use prayer on them, we'll find that the fear will disappear. Now, if we have clearing away the things that block us from God, you know, that was the theme of this whole process of the inventory. It says now we got to get rid of the things that block us. And one of the things that block us from God is fear. Now, it's a spiritual sickness. But as we have done this, we have removed the fears from our mind. And this is a large area that has dominated our mind. And if we have worked this part of step four, then we are carrying out a decision. Because now God can come in to direct the area of our lives that was controlled by fear. And we've cleared away two areas. We've cleared away fear, we've cleared away resentments. So we are carrying out the decision in step three by the actions we've taken in step four. And step four, as we keep on saying, is a very positive cleansing step. It's not just the step. It's one of the most powerful steps that eliminate things in the whole process. If we do it as the big book says, do it. And now that we have done this, we have got all on this list, we got all the information we need for step 5, 6, and 7. In the fourth column, we got the things we're going to talk to another person about. We got the things in the fourth column that we want to be willing to let go of, and we're going to ask God to remove in 7. So right up here, and we got the part of self that is involved step 3. So we got on this sheet, we got information that was in step 3. We got, and it is step 4. We got the information for 5. We got the information for 6. And we got the information for 7. We're going to also find that some of these people, when we analyze this list of fears, we're going to find that some of these people that we fear and things we fear, we owe an amend. So we're making the list for step 8 and 9 while we're doing step 4. So we also are making step lists for 89. So we got all the steps laid out in front of us and all the information for the rest of the program on SEER.
The simplicity of this thing continues to amaze me. The more I fool with it, the more amazed I am by it. The more I realize that we've been looking at our damaged and unsaleable stock in trade.
Right.
Stock in trade being our thought patterns.
Right.
And two of our damaged and unsaleable items are stock in trade that has blocked us off from God are the resentments and the fears. God can't enter that kind of mind. We've looked at them. We've analyzed them. We've found out how to get rid of them. And we're beginning to see how to keep them from coming back in the future. And in doing so, we also have developed the information that we're going to need really for the next six steps. We're going to use this same process in step 10. And we'll see that as we go through the book. So we're laying out everything we need for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. And as soon as we finish up the resentment, then things are the inventory, then things start moving very rapidly. And we're looking at the symptoms of spiritual illness, the things that block us off from God. And we've looked at resentments. We have looked at fears. Now, there's one other area dealing with our third basic instinct of life that is called the sex instinct. And it seems as though that's such a powerful driving force that we seem to hurt more people that way faster than we do any other way. And it seems to give us more trouble than just about anything else in our life because of the fact that it is such a driving force. So our book is going to ask us to look at the third common manifestation of self. And we're going to look at those people we have harmed. Remember, a definition of a wrong, one definition is harmful acts or acts that result in harm to other people. And we're going to look at our sex conduct of the past to see those persons that we have harmed in this third basic instinct of life. Cliff, will you stick that on there for me, okay? Oh, excuse me, that's resentments. That's sex. Let's get into sex. Hell with that resentment. We've got enough of that. That's the only reason Cliff came up here. He knows we talk about sex on Sunday. Now, page 68, last paragraph says, now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. Now, you older fellas, don't get your hope up. This doesn't deal with physical sex. We're talking about mental or emotional sex, or the way we think about it rather than how we do it. It said, above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices that cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. And you and I have heard those voices all of our life. That's the bunch of people that say sex is a bad thing, that it really should not be enjoyed, that it should be used for only one thing, to reproduce the human race, and you ought to do it at one time, in one position, with one person only, and to enjoy it is a sinful thing. And I've heard those voices all my life. It says, then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. Now, we've got that set of voices also, and we've always heard them. Those are the voices that say that you ought to be able to do sex anytime you want to. You ought to be able to do it anywhere you want to, with anybody you want to, in any position you want to, as many times as you want to, with as many people as you want to, and you ought to enjoy it every time, and if you don't, there's something wrong with you. You know, I think maybe they call that the sexual revolution. And the main thing I see wrong with that is it occurred about 25 years too late for me to really participate in it. You know, this sex thing in human beings is entirely different than it is in the other animals on the face of the earth. The real thing is that you and I think about sex where the other animals can't. When it comes time for the other animals to reproduce their race, whatever it is, they do that solely at the direction of God. When it's time for them to reproduce, God will usually signify that by some physical change in the female of the species, and it occurs at a certain time of the year. And then when the female of the species becomes ready for sex, the male senses that, the male prepares himself, the two join together, and it's kind of like bang, bang, thank you, ma'am. And just as soon as it's over, they go their individual ways. Now, they didn't think about it beforehand, and they didn't think about it while doing it, and they don't think about it after it's done. They do these things purely at God's direction. They have no choice. But since God gave you and I self-will, He gives us the ability to choose. We don't have to wait for a certain time of the year to do it. We can do sex anytime we want to. We have that choice. And we don't have to do it with any one certain individual. We can do it with anybody we want to. And we don't have to do it in any one particular position. We can do it in any position we want to. And we can do it as many times as we want to, any positions we want to, any way we want to. In other words, we can make choices. And I think that's our problem right there. If we didn't have any choice in the matter, it wouldn't give us such trouble, but we've got to make decisions about it all the time. And since sex is such a great, tremendous thing, since God makes it a very pleasurable thing, so we will do it to reproduce our race, that pleasure is so intense that we get from it, it seems to create an insatiable desire for more of the same. And we begin to do it at the wrong time, in the wrong place, with the wrong people. And when we do that, we begin to hurt other people. And they, in turn, retaliate against us. And that, in turn, begins to create pain and suffering for us. And we're going to find as we go through this little part of the book that the question of morality doesn't even enter the picture. What the book is going to do is give me a way to look at my past sex conduct, to see if I've harmed people with it, and it's going to give me a way then to perhaps shape a new sex conduct of the future so that maybe I'm not always harming people with it, which in turn creates the pain and the suffering for me. It says one school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. I just love the way old Bill writes. It says we want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? And I read that with great relief, that they're not going to condemn me for what I've been in the past, nor are they going to try to tell me what I'm going to have to do in the future. They're going to give me a way to determine for myself. But they themselves do not condemn me, nor do they try to tell me what to do in the future. It says we reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. So we see the same set of instructions that we saw for resentments and that we see for fears, except he just worded it a little differently. He's not about to repeat himself exactly the same way any time in the book. Column 1, who did I hurt? Now, most of us in some way or other have hurt people, other human beings, by our sexual conduct of the past. Maybe we went out and did things outside of marriage, and we got caught at it, and our spouses found out about it. Well, most certainly that's hurt our spouse. If we have children in this marriage, and it created a real problem in our home, then we most certainly probably have hurt our children. If the partner outside of marriage, if it's found out and her spouse knows about it, then most certainly we've hurt both of them. And if there's children involved in their marriage, most certainly we've hurt those children also. Maybe we didn't do anything particularly outside of marriage, though. But maybe we demand more than our fair share of sex. And maybe we're demanding that the people we have sex with do it with us when they really don't want to. Now, if that's true, we've hurt them, at least in the emotional area. Maybe we like to do sex in ways that they don't particularly like to do it. And maybe we demand that they do it in ways and positions that they really don't want, but we insist that they do it anyway. Most certainly we are hurting those people. Maybe we haven't done anything to them physically at all. But maybe we've created jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness in their minds. And sometimes we do that deliberately. Sometimes our partner's not paying attention to us like they should. And we say, well, we'll damn sure stir them up. And we go to the party tonight and we start a little flirtation with a member of the opposite sex outside of our relationship. We deliberately do that to create jealousy and suspicion in the minds of our spouses or our partners that we're living with at that time. And if so, we have definitely hurt them. Maybe we have withheld sex. Maybe we don't really like to do it very much, so we just kind of cut the partners out and say, well, we're just not going to have any sex in our relationship. And by being very selfish with sex, then certainly we're hurting another human being. And I find that in the majority of the cases, as we fill out who did we hurt, and column 2, what did we do, and then column 3, what part of self caused this, I think the most amazing thing that I found out is most of the people that I hurt by my sexual conduct of the past, that it really wasn't caused by the sex instinct at all. That it was usually caused by one of the other two instincts. Now, once in a while, to get the physical gratification, to get the great physical release that comes at the moment of successful completion of the sex act, sometimes we do the wrong thing at the wrong time in the wrong place with the wrong people because of the sex instinct. But I think most of us will find that the majority of those things were caused not by the sex instinct, but by the social instinct or the material instinct. You know, as young fellows growing up, we learned at a very early age that the more members of the opposite sex that you can have a relationship with, then the greater man you really are. You know, you can really build your ego and your self-image through sex. Now, we boys call that John Wayneism. I have no idea what you girls called it, but we called it John Wayneism. And the more members of the opposite sex you can attract to yourself, then the greater you can really be in your own mind. And if you're using sex for that purpose, then that's not what God really intended for sex to be used for. God intended for it to be pleasurable, and He made it pleasurable to reproduce the human race. And I think if we're using sex to reproduce the human race or strictly to enjoy it, it's okay. But if we're using it to build our self-esteem, then that really isn't what God intended for it to be used for. Sometimes we use sex to buy emotional security. Maybe we're just lonesome. And maybe we just want somebody to recognize us. And maybe we just want another human being to have something to do with us. And we find that if we give sex, we can buy back personal relationships and emotional security. Now, if that's what we're using sex for, then that really isn't what it was intended for in the first place. Maybe we're using sex to buy material security. Maybe we're in a position where we really don't enjoy sex, don't even want anything to do with the other person, but we find that if we don't give sex to them, then we cannot get back the material security that they represent for us. And if we're using sex for that purpose, then that is not what God intended for it to be. Sometimes we use sex to get even with another person. You know, maybe the other partner in our relationship, they go out and they do something that they shouldn't do, and we find out about it, and we say, by God, we'll show them. And we'll go out and we'll do exactly the same thing. Now, the fallacy in that is after we've done it, we can't afford to tell them we did it. But there, we're not using sex for God's purposes. We're using sex there to get even with another human being. Sometimes we use sex to force our will on another human being. Maybe they're not doing what we want them to do. So we say, well, we'll just cut them off at the pass. We won't let them have any until they come around to our way of thinking. And we're using the withholding of sex to force our will on another human being. Now, we boys aren't too good at that. We only last 2 or 3 days. But I'll guarantee you, you girls have honed that to perfection. You know exactly how to do it. And I don't blame you, because it works every damn time. If it worked that good for me, I'd do it all the time. So there's many ways that we harm other people. by our sexual conduct, misconduct, lack of conduct in the sexual area. Mm-hmm. And when we hurt other people in this area, then invariably they're going to turn around and retaliate against us and try to get even with us. And that creates pain and suffering, not only for them, but for us too. It's plain that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success. So the book gives me a way, through a simple little form, to take a look at this stuff and see what I've been doing with it in the past. And in each case, we always read from left to right as the final thing, and we say, what's the exact nature of the wrong? Now, the harm we did to the other human being is the wrong, but what's the nature of the wrong? And I see the same old character that pops up in resentments and fears. If I wasn't so selfish, I wouldn't be doing those things. If I wasn't so dishonest, I wouldn't be doing that kind of stuff. If I wasn't so frightened, I wouldn't be out there doing that stuff. If I had more consideration of my wife and my children, I wouldn't be out there doing that kind of stuff. And if I don't change that old personality, I'm going to keep right on doing the same old things over and over and over again. So I see here the same problem creates the sex problems that created the resentment, that created the fears. And I think the other thing that really amazes me is I see the same names popping up. Same old deal. My wife Barbara appeared on all three of these sheets. I resented her, I feared her, and I hurt her by my conduct in the past. Now, if I don't want to be that way anymore, then my personality is going to have to change. So now then, I have looked at the three common symptoms of spiritual illness. Resentment, fear, and harms done to another human being. I've seen the exact nature of each one of those things. And the exact nature of each one is that old selfish, self-seeking, frightened, dishonest, inconsiderate character. Now, if I can become spiritually well, then those resentments, fears and harms will disappear, and my personality will change, and I will become an entirely different person. Today I realize this inventory is complete. I really don't need anything else. I look back in my life now, and I see that every problem I've ever had has manifested itself in one of those three ways. I've either been mad at somebody, I have been afraid of somebody, or I have done something that's hurt somebody. And I'm convinced today that every problem I'll have in the future will manifest itself as one of those three things. I'll be mad, I'll be afraid, or I'll be hurting people. And I don't think we need anything else, period, than the inventory we have in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if we can eliminate this stuff, then we are going to become spiritually well people. And the book says when the spiritual malady is overcome, then the mental and the physical will straighten out. So I don't think I need any more inventory, period, than what's in the book itself.
Okay. In this way, by doing this, by looking at the past, and the child has said, this is the only way we're putting it down, not to judge it, not to get into a moral issue. The only way we can look at plans for the future is to look at the past. In this way, we try to shape a sane idea of our future sex life. By doing this, we subject each relation to the test, was it selfish or not? And that's easy to look at once you can get it on paper.
You know, the book doesn't care how you do sex. If you want to do sex hanging upside down from a tree limb by your toenails, that's fine with the book. But if you're forcing another human being to have sex with you hanging upside down from a tree limb by their toenails when they don't want to, then that's probably for selfish reasons. It said, let's look at each situation. Is it purely selfish or not? If another human being is involved in this, is it hurting them? If so, it's probably for selfish reasons.
It said, we ask God, and then we have prayer throughout there, about three prayers in six. We ask God to mold our ideas and help us to live up to them. Remember always that our sex powers are God-given.
Got three prayers and sex. I've never been able to find anything more spiritual than sex. I spent the first half of my life praying to do it twice and the last half praying to do it once. It's damn spiritual.
Remember always, sex parts are God-given, therefore good. Neither to be used lightly, selfish, despised, or loathed. Whatever our ideal is trying to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. You know, whatever we set our standards, we got to grow toward that standard. It's not just a bang overnight thing where we're going to do it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided we do not bring about still more harm in doing so. Already, he's mentioned, we got that, he is mentioned in step 9. When to do so would injure them or others. You know, he's telling us on this sex thing, there might be some things that we can't make amends for. In other words, we treat sex as if we're in a problem in meditation. Again, we have a little prayer. Well, it's got what we should do in each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. And this is very, very important to look at. Other persons often counsel with other persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. You know, this is important here. I think, you know, we can get a lot of help from people. Particularly in AA, if you got something you want to do, you can talk to enough AA members, you find a number of them agree with you if you keep on going. You know. And I think we said we let God be the final judge in this case as far as our sex life is concerned. And that's nothing new to me. You know, I reflected back on this. You know, when they talk about God in our lives and knowing right from wrong and this voice that speaks to us, even in my days of drinking, in my days when I was running the show, every time I was in a sexual situation that was wrong, you know, I knew it was wrong. For some reason, I knew this. I did it anyway, but I knew it was wrong. So if what he's saying now, why don't we listen to that voice? You know, and because we don't know which person we're talking to when we talk about, you know, people have different we're different in different sexual standards in people, and it's different acceptable things in different parts of the country. You're probably right here in Denton, you know, sexual situations is different than in Houston or Dallas, maybe. You know, what they do over there won't be accepted here. You know, and what some of the things they do here is different than in Little Rock. And I'm sure the sexual what's accepted here is different than San Francisco, you know, it's according to where you're at. They got different things are acceptable. But what we got to look at our own, we're looking not at the rules of our society, not at the rules of our group, we're looking at our rules. This thing, let that thing within us speak what is best for us. We realize that some people are fanatical about sex and others are loose. We avoid hysteria, thinking our advice in this area. Suppose we fall short of this chosen idea and stumble. Does this mean to be going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only half true. You know, this is an area that we may make mistakes in. It depends upon our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have an honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we'll be forgiven, okay, and have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, and that's the key to it, we're quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing on these are facts of our experience. And these people had experience with that. You know, the things that are happening in AA groups today along these lines, this is not new. You know, it was happening in those days, and they learned the lesson from it and gave us this program. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right idea for guidance in each questionable situation, for our sanity and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves hard into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves and requires the imperious urge when the yell would mean heartache. And here he gives us another tool for sex. If it's very troublesome, work with another alcoholic. Now, that seems strange.
But it's one thing, you know, in working with another alcoholic, any time that one alcoholic gets involved with another alcoholic, it's a real natural thing for us to become so consumed in his life. That once we begin involved in his life, we get out of ourselves. This is one way to escape from self, is to get involved with another alcoholic. And it seems that when we can get involved with another alcoholic, then God can come and work into our lives. Okay, now we have a summary here. Let's summarize what we have completed in this whole inventory process. And again, on this sheet, we'll have all the information that we need. We have the information, the exact nature of the harm, that what caused us to do this harm. We can trace it back to the fourth column. The exact nature of the harm to the other person was our selfishness, our self-centeredness, our dishonesty, our frightened, our inconsiderate. It was one of those things, or a combination of those things, which was the exact nature of the harm. So in 4, 5, 6, and 7, we got that in that list, in that fourth column. We can also see which part of self was involved in there. Well, we got that in the third column. We also have the list of the people we have harmed over in 8 and 9. We're going to add that to the list of some we got off of fear, and we're going to add that to some we got off of resentment. So we got the list of people we have harmed for 8 and 9. We got the things we're going to talk about to another person in step 5, what we're going to be willing to let go in 6, and what we're going to ask God to remove in 7. So on this list, we got all the information for the rest of the steps. Now, it says, if we have been through our inventory, we have written down a lot. We really have. God, this is there is nothing like the inventory in the big book. God, it is so, gives us so much information compacted down with no other garbage, nothing else involved, just plain information, if we do it like the big book says, do it. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We'll go a little further. We have also listed and analyzed our fears. We have also listed and analyzed our sex conduct of the past. We have listed and analyzed them. Not just listing them, but analyzed them. We have seen the truth. You know, and they say the truth will set you free. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destruction. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look at them as sick people. And we said that we're going to have some personality change, sufficient to recover from alcoholism. And right here in step 4, after we do this, this is the first personality change. Right here it says, we have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. We look at them as sick people. And this is a lot of personality change for an alcoholic. You know, in step 1 and 2, we didn't get anything. You know, they weren't steps we took. Step 3 was just the beginning. We didn't get any personality change from step 3. This is the first personality change after the action steps. From now on, we're going to get some other personality change after each step. That we have listed people we have hurt by our conduct and our will to straighten out the past. We have the list made out. They all came off of the first column.
And if you find anybody else that you have harmed in any way other than sex, just go ahead and put them on the list.
Analyze
them out at the same time.
That's right.
We're going to have that when we get to step 8.
Right.
So if I've stolen from somebody, I put their name down, analyze them out just like I do with the sex conduct.
Right.
I make a full list to the best of my ability of all the people I've harmed in the past.
Just another warning, just don't put that person's name on the list and say, I harmed him. But put down what you did, which part of self was involved, caused you to do it, and which character defect. Be sure to carry it on through and get to the truth of it. For you're not doing it for his benefit, you're trying to find out something about yourself. Okay. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now, God, if once we analyze this, God, we can see, we can become convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you have already made a decision,
step three,
and an inventory of your grosser handicaps,
step four,
you have made the good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. And it says grosser handicaps.
So let's don't wait for step four until we get perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the best thing we can do is look at these grosser handicaps and get on about our business.
That's right.
Those of us that are waiting to do step four until we get perfect, what we're really saying is we're going to get well before we do step four. And that's got the cart before the horse. We do the steps, and then we get well. So if we'll get on with four, look at these grosser handicaps, and that's probably going to give us enough relief to be able to stay sober long enough to go on with the rest of the program. But those of us that wait until we get perfect first, we never do finish up step four. We can't be perfect anyhow. And it said you have swallowed some and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Say we took a moral inventory, and we saw that the word moral meant truth. And we've truthfully looked at ourselves in the area of resentments, fears, and harms done to other people. And we've never done that before. We always looked at the resentment, but that's it. We always looked at the fear, but that's it. We always looked at what we did, but that's it. We never did analyze it out and see the real truth of the matter. And the real truth of the matter is that we are our own problem. We make our own problems through that old selfish personality that we have become by living on self-will. Now, I don't know whether you all have noticed or not, but the majority of the information in the big book on sex is found on page 69. I don't know that that means anything at all, but that is where almost all of it is found, on page 69. Don't tell me Bill Wilson didn't have a sense of humor. We heard a story not too long ago about a young lady who had come to AA, and she was having difficulty with this sex thing, and she went to her sponsor and told her, said, I'm having a hell of a time with this sex thing since I've been sober. And the sponsor said, oh, how come? And she said, well, sober, I just don't know anything about it. She said, I've never had sex sober, always been drunk, don't know what to do. And she said, I've never been able to attract members of the opposite sex to me sober. I just don't know how to function that way. And the sponsor said, well, what you need to do is go home, get out your big book, and read page 69. And she said, you'll find on page 69 all the answers to any problems you might have in the sexual area. So the young lady said, okay. She went home, got out her big book, and started to read page 69, but she got confused and couldn't remember the proper page, and she read page 96 instead. Let's go to page 96 and see what she read, just for the hell of it. Go ahead and read it and see what she read. You can read page 96 and 97. The whole thing fits all the way through there. That second paragraph, it says, let him know you're available if he wishes to make a decision. Okay, let's go to page 72 into action. Having made our personal inventory, what should we do about it? We've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. You see, we didn't look for assets. We look for damaged and unsaleable goods, those things we want to get rid of. Now, these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which, when completed, will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. Now, step 5 says we admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. But if you'll notice in the narrative here in the book, he uses the exact nature of our defects. And again, people used to ask Bill about this. They'd say, Bill, why do you do this kind of stuff? Why did you put wrongs in the step and you talk about defects in the book? And why did you use wrongs in 5 and then you talked about defects in 6? And by the way, Bill, why do you use shortcomings in 7? What's the difference in those things? And Bill's answer always was, when they taught me those English and writing courses in college, they taught me not to use the same words over and over. That shows how ignorant you really are. He said, what difference does it make what we call them, as long as we recognize what they are in step 4? And then we're going to talk about them to somebody else in 5. And we're going to become willing to get rid of them in 6. And we're going to ask God to take them away in 7. He said you can call them anything you want to. And as we go through the book, we're going to notice him referring to them as wrongs, faults, mistakes, defects, shortcomings, flaws. He uses several words that mean the same identical things. Let's watch him as we go through the book. He said, this brings us to the 5th step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. Now, this is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we've done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reason why we should do so. The best reason first, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. And that's about as good a reason as I can think of. But then on the next 2 pages, he explains why that's true. He talks to us about the fact that time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about themselves. Trying to avoid this humming experience, they've turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they failed. Well, we think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, honesty, in the sense that we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. Now again, here's where we ran into the problem. We read all the life story, and we said, oh, that's what they want us to do in step 4. And that's when we begin to write our whole life history. And as we can see, 95% of the life history has nothing to do with the drinking anyhow. So it's really a waste of time. We have shared all our life story in the 3 areas that really matter, the 3 common symptoms or manifestations of the spiritual malady. We've shared all our life story in resentments, because if we list all we've got in our head today, they really have been placed there throughout our entire lifetime. So we're sharing all of our life story in that area. The same with fears. They have been placed in my head throughout my entire lifetime. The same with harms to other people. Now, most of us have been hurting people forever. My mother said to me one night, she said, Charlie, you are a hell of a kid. She said, I have difficulty loving you myself. She said, hell, you've been hurting people long as I can remember. And I always have due to my selfishness. So I'm sharing all my life story in the 3 areas that really have something to do with my alcoholism. Resentments, fears, and harms done to other people. Now then, he says, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much to the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. The book's already told us we are real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, alcohol is a sedative drug that lowers the inhibitions. And we put alcohol in our head and lower the inhibitions, we do some damn strange things. And we really don't want people to know about that. And we would rather not know about it ourselves. So we, on one hand, when drinking, we're living one life, whereas when we're sober, we've got a set of morals, we've got a good philosophy of life, and we try to live up to that sober, so we really are leading two lives. We are very much the actor. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he's revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension, and that makes for more drinking. In other words, we try to repress those ideas and those things we've done and bury them deep inside of ourselves, and we get to be real experts at doing this. You know, you and I have become the world's greatest con artist. We couldn't live with ourselves if we didn't have the ability to do this. If I couldn't take these things and bury them inside me where I don't have to look at them, then I wouldn't be able to live with the guilt and the remorse and the fear associated with those things, and I've become an expert at it. Now, all of a sudden, when I take step four, am I going to be 100% honest with me? No way. Hell, I'm an expert at conning me. And after 18 years sobriety, I am still damn good at it. You know, you can have a $100 bill sticking out of your pocket, and I can steal that $100 bill and give me 30 seconds, and I'll figure out how I've done you a favor by stealing your $100 bill. And there's no way we're going to honestly look at ourselves when we take step four. We're going to do the best we can, and that's all we can do. Psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We spent thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we've given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Really, it doesn't make any sense. We'll pay a psychologist or a psychiatrist from $50 to $100 an hour for the privilege of lying on their couch and telling them lies the whole damn hour. We're not about to tell them the truth. We can't. Now, if I want to get all I can out of step four, I need to find me another human being who knows what I'm trying to do. Hopefully, who has walked the walk before me and understand what's going on. So that person can help me be honest with me. When I took my step forward to this fellow down the way the big book says to do it, some of mine where I had marked down that it was caused by the sex instinct, he said, "Oh, no, Charlie." He said, "Hell, you're just trying to build your self-esteem here."